The casualties mount. The American Army has lost nearly 1,000 men the last 2 weeks. The South Vietnamese Army has lost only slightly less, and that rather ghoulish scalp count, which is called a kill count, kept by our troops in Saigon, would seem to indicate that the enemy has lost some 4,500 men in the same period. Since the Tet offensive of the Viet Cong in early January, nearly 500,000 Vietnamese children and women and men have become homeless and destitute and joined the nearly 2 million refugees who live aimless, nearly starving lives in relocation camps. 1 in 6 in South Vietnam is today a refugee. 1 in 20 in South Vietnam has died a violent death. Civilian casualties outnumber military casualties by a ratio of 3 to 1. Casualties mount and the costs mount. The economists tell us that this adventure in Southeast Asia is costing us nearly $2 billion a month. And this is money which we are borrowing against our cities and our educational system, our welfare programs, all that makes for the sturdiness and the strength of this nation. If the present rate of escalation continues, the Vietnamese adventure will be costing the American people $1 billion a week by the end of this year. And the more the crisis deepens, the more the crisis in our cities deepen. For every dollar spent abroad is a dollar we cannot spend at home. And the more the crisis in Vietnam worsens, the more the fabric of American society is being pulled apart, riven in twain. For we are people deeply divided. Divided on the philosophy of the war as well as its strategy. Divided as to the morality of our actions as well as to their urgency. We are a people today which cannot set its own priorities. The urgency of the nation is in our cities, in our own homes. Presidential commissions report that unless we spend sums equal to those we are spending in Vietnam, we can expect Vietnams in Cleveland, in Detroit, in Chicago, in all the major cities of the nation. But the reports are secondary headlines. The large black headlines reporting the cost and the course of the war. And time passes on, and points of no return are passed, and we seem unable to change this course towards a war which many say we cannot win, and which no one can really explain to us in terms of what we will have won if we do, in fact, win. The casualties mount, the costs mount, the devastation grows apace. We saved a city of 35,000 people by destroying it. Wei, the ancient capital of South Vietnam, of Vietnam, lies today in rubble, ruins. Apparently we have given the green light to our bombers to bomb freely in Hanoi and Haiphong. And I wonder how long it will be before Aleutian bombers lent to the North Vietnamese begin to bomb Saigon and Danang. Vietnam is today a devastated place. The chemicals which we have dropped in our defoliant operations are beginning to leach out the fertility of the soil. The trees have lost their leaves, the ground has lost its fertility, the people have lost their lives and their will to live. All this to save for them that precious freedom about which so much American oratory has spoken so grandly. The casualties have mounted, the cost of the war has mounted, the devastation has increased, and the war, of course, has not been going well. We've been bombing for 2 years. Bombing was to be the key to the solution of this Vietnamese war, key to victory. It would bring the enemy to negotiate at the table on our terms. And then we began to hear that, of course, you can bomb bridges and you can bomb rail yards and you can bomb roads, but you can't bomb mountain trails at night. And the soldiers, the Vietnamese, were slipping through with a little pack on their back, and that's why the bombing wasn't working. And then 3 weeks ago, North Vietnamese tanks and heavy cannon appeared south of the 17th parallel. It appears that heavy bombing cannot prevent the movement of armor or equipment. The Tet Offensive was reported positively in the United States. The enemy attacked and entered and for a time controlled parts or all of 35 cities in Vietnam. Somehow this well-organized operation was transformed by what is called in government jargon positive reporting. It was transformed into a victory for the American side. We were told, after all, they didn't succeed in holding the cities. And we were told, of course, there was no spontaneous uprising by the Vietnamese. But I confess I didn't hear one report of any Vietnam citizen who told the Americans there's a suspicious column of enemy troops entering the city or living in my neighbor's home. And I see the reports of the Green Berets and the South Vietnamese who have been pulled back from the countryside, so that in fact the Tet Offensive lost the Americans control of whatever areas of rural Vietnam we claim to have pacified. And returned that control, day and night, to the Viet Cong and Hanoi. The war has not been going well for us. We're told in black headlines in the evening paper that if we are not to retreat into the enclaves which some of our generals spoke about a year and a half ago, perhaps 1 million Americans will have to be committed to this area. Perhaps more. I've tried to understand our position in Vietnam. I've tried to wrestle through and reason through the various explanations which have been given to us. And I find, I must confess, that here too there has been a credibility gap. I don't believe that we ever went into Vietnam in order to protect the freedom of a small, freedom-loving people from communism. Dictatorship, a la Bao Dai, or a la Diem, is no better and no worse than communism. South Vietnam never was a unified nation. South Vietnam never had a tradition of freedom. And I confess that the parallels to Munich as an explanation of our involvement in Vietnam escape me. One cannot police the world. One can prevent major aggression by major powers. as certainly we should have prevented it at Munich if we could have. But Hanoi does not qualify as Hitler's Germany. Even had Hanoi conquered quickly all of South Vietnam, even had all of Vietnam become a communist nation, I fail to understand how this in any way would have threatened the security of the rest of the globe. And I cannot believe that our defense of the freedoms of the South Vietnamese could have been worth the freedom which they presumably would have lost. What then can explain our involvement in South Vietnam? The usual explanation of this quagmire of what might be called in less polite society this mess. The usual explanation is it is compounded of drift and indecision and of minor commitments which suddenly exploded into commitments of 500,000 men or 1,000,000 men or more. And there's a certain sad truth to this commentary on the widespread and sweeping commitments which the United States 10 and 20 years ago made around the world. But certainly in the last 3 years, the last 4 years, no one has been ignorant or innocent of Vietnam. Vietnam has been at the focal point, at the center of all of our political decision making. There have been administration white papers, and there have been contrary opinions by reporters from the scene and by scholars. There's been constant debate. Innocence, indecision, these can no longer be used as explanation of the rapid escalation of since 1965. It is my firm opinion that we went into Vietnam in 1954 and that we have remained in Vietnam and remain there today, not because of anything that the Viet Cong might do to the Saigon government, not because of anything Hanoi might do to South Vietnam, but because we are very much afraid of what Peking might do to Washington. This Vietnamese, North and South, are tragic pawns in a power battle between giant, giant global powers. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, there were nationalist communist fronts in Indonesia fighting the Dutch, and the American government saw no reason to interfere. During these same years, there was a communist nationalist front in Malaysia fighting the British, and the United States government saw no reason to interfere. Why did we interfere in Indochina? Because the border of Indochina is China's southern border. But between Malaysia and China, there's the whole sweep of Thailand. And between Indonesia and China, there's 1,000 miles of water. I am firmly convinced that had Ho Chi Minh worked out his National Liberation Front and there had been 200 miles of land and water between China and Indochina, we would never have involved ourselves with any group in Vietnam. We fear China. Only this explanation can afford us the reason for what President Johnson calls today backing up our boys and what the press today calls mulishness, can afford explanation of why we persevere and why we continue long after any hope of solving Vietnam's problems have obviously gone out the window. It was Mr. Dulles who first wanted to involve us in a major way in Vietnam. And he managed to do so. And he did so because he delighted in seeing the communist world as a monolith, an outlaw world, an atheist world, expansionist, determined to move out and to conquer and to subvert, and to dominate the globe. And he saw the effect of NATO and of the Marshall Plan and the foreign aid in Europe, and fearing in the early 1950s the expansion of China in Southeast Asia and in Asia, he attempted to duplicate this policy of containment there. The guns and the aid we'd given to Greece and to Turkey, the Marshall Plan, would be duplicated by the guns and the aid which we'd give to the French and into China. And so by the end of the Indo-Chinese War, the United States was paying 90% of the cost of that war. And when Dien Bien Phu came about, Mr. Dulles submitted to the American government a proposal for airstrikes and ultimate ground support of the French. He was determined to keep a group of states which were militarily allied to the West on the borders of the communist world. But interestingly, our chiefs of staff overruled him. General Matthew Ridgway, who had been the commander in Korea, who was the Army chiefs of staff, and General Gavin, who was his chief of planning. These men remembered the motto of General MacArthur not to be involved in a land war in Asia. And these men persuaded a president who was also a military man of first order that it was folly and worse for America, which was sophisticated in weaponry but was a moderate power in manpower, for America to involve itself in a land and terrain thousands of miles from our bases of supply, in a land and a terrain whose configuration made it difficult for our technical advantage to assert itself. The Joint Chiefs of Staff were called then by the State Department the Never Again Club. They had been bruised in Korea. They had learned in that small peninsula the dangers, the abyss, which is a land war in Asia, and they were determined never again to allow the American armies to be trapped in such a morass. And interestingly, in 1954, a senator from Texas, Lyndon Johnson, was among the men who asked the most acid and acerbic questions of Secretary Dulles when he submitted his proposal for military aid to the French to a small group of influential senators in Washington. How is it then that 18 years later, 20,000 lives later, despite the overwhelming military opinion, which is to the contrary, we find ourselves involved in a war in Asia, a war which is within inches of being not only a Vietnamese war, but is spreading across the entire Southeast Asian subcontinent. Until the last month or so in Laos, which the Hanoi Chinese governments sponsored the Pathet Lao, and we were bombing the Ho Chi Minh Trail, but it was done without being done in the open. Our planes were unmarked. Now there are open operations. The Pathet Lao is moving closer and closer to the Thai border. Our planes are taking off openly from Saigon and from Thailand to bomb in Laos. Activity, guerrilla activity in the northeast provinces of Thailand has increased, as has the rate of our military buildup in that land. We are within inches of a war which was spread across all of Southeast Asia. How did all this come about? And the only explanation that I can give is that from the very beginning, fear of China, fear of the 700 million Chinese, fear of Chinese, red Chinese expansion has been the unspoken, compelling, and dominant element in our policy. It was not Vietnam. It was not any government in Saigon. It was not any freedoms which the Saigon people, which the Vietnamese had or did not have. But our own visceral free fear of red China. This was true in the early days. Doris did not talk of fear when we sent our, of Vietnamese freedoms, when we sent our first troops, first technicians, first military aid to Bao Dai, the old Mandarin puppet who ruled autocratically. He spoke of China. China. In October of last year, in one of his more candid press interviews, Secretary of State spoke openly of China. Let me quote to you from this October press interview of Dean Rusk's. The question is this. Mr. Secretary, one of the basic questions that seems to be emerging in this Senate debate is whether our national security is really at stake in Vietnam, and whether Vietnam represents an integral part of our defense perimeter in the Pacific. Answer. Within the next decade or two, there will be a billion Chinese on the mainland, armed with nuclear weapons, with no certainty about what their attitude towards the rest of Asia will be. Now, the free nations of Asia will make up at least a billion people. They don't want China to overrun them on the basis of a doctrine of the world revolution. The militancy of China has isolated China, even within the communist world. But they have not drawn back from it. They have reaffirmed it as recently as their reception of their great and good friend Albania 2 days ago. And we believe the free nations of Asia must brace themselves, get themselves set, with secure, progressive, stable institutions of their own, with cooperation among the free nations of Asia, if there is to be peace in Asia over the next 10 or 20 years. We would hope that in China there would emerge a generation of leadership that would think seriously about what is called peaceful coexistence, that would recognize the pragmatic necessity for human beings to live together in peace rather than on a basis of continuing warfare. Now, from a strategic point of view, it is not very attractive to think of the world cut in two by Asian communism, reaching out through Southeast Asia and Indonesia, which we know has been their objective, and that these hundreds of millions of people in the free nations of Asia should be under the deadly and constant pressure of the authorities in Peking, so their future is circumscribed by fear. Now, these are vitally important matters to us, we who are both a Pacific and Atlantic power. After all, World War II hit us from the Pacific, and Asia is where two-thirds of the world's peoples live. So we have a tremendous stake in the ability of the free nations of Asia to live in peace and to turn the interests of people in mainland Asia, in mainland China, to the pragmatic requirements of their own people and away from a doctrinaire and ideological adventurism abroad. China, the fear of China as an enemy, I submit, has been the undergirding element which alone explains the persistence, the doggedness, the steadfastness, as some would call it, of our policy in Southeast Asia. Now, if this be so, let us examine China as an enemy. Let us ask whether China really threatens the security of the United States. If it does, the administration's program may have some validity. If it does not, it is founded on quicksand. I would offer to you two kinds of analysis. The first accepts the proposition that China is indeed a threat to American security. And my first line of analysis leads me to the conclusion that even so, this present involvement in South Vietnam is tactically stupid. The Vietnamese people have for 1,000 years, as you know, suffered the rapacity of Chinese overlords and of Chinese military attack and of Chinese domination. Ho Chi Minh himself, as you may not know, spent 21 months in a Chinese prison locked in stocks. One of the reasons that Ho Chi Minh accepted the Geneva Accords of 1954 was that it put observers from the International Control Commission on his northern border between China and his own nation. And though he has, of course, accepted a good bit of Chinese aid, he has not yet brought into his armies Chinese technicians, Chinese tacticians, or Chinese troops. The Vietnamese are a proud and independent people. This nationalism which is bursting across our globe bubbles up also in that nation. They have no reason to want the Chinese again as overlords. Indeed, they will do all that they can to avoid that conclusion. China can move into Southeast Asia under one condition only, and that is that this part of the world be reduced to rubble, that it would have become a power vacuum, that there would not be any effective government in Hanoi and Saigon which could oppose the Chinese expansion. And I submit that this is the very condition that we are creating. And I would put before you a very interesting battle which has been going on between the Chinese press and the Hanoi press, between those who obviously control the policies of government in both nations. China has argued vehemently for the past 2 years against the Hanoi decision, the decision of General Giap, to escalate their response from a guerrilla war to a war involving larger units of troops. The Chinese have said that only by a long-range war of attrition, a sudden shot out of the darkness, only in such a way can the Vietnamese hope to win. And the Vietnamese have seen that they can ultimately be blotted, blasted off the face of the earth by American power, that they must escalate the war, and that this escalation, of course, brings in with it the possibility of major victory or major defeat. They're willing to throw the gauntlet down in battle. And the Chinese don't want victory or defeat in Vietnam. A North Vietnamese victory means the establishment of a government much like Tito's Yugoslavia on their borders. Communist in form, yes, but anti-Chinese in its policy. And defeat implies American or South Vietnamese troops right on the Chinese border. And of course, this is an eventuality that they do not want. And so the Chinese have tried to counsel the Vietnamese to continue the guerrilla warfare, that state of anarchy in which one country cannot lose, in which Vietnam cannot lose and it cannot win, in which it is slowly ground into the dust. Because this prolonged kind of battle is the very kind which can allow, which will allow Vietnam to be gobbled up into the Chinese province without any real effort, real loss, a real risk by the Chinese. But let's ask the question from another point of view. Is China the enemy? And does China present a threat to the security of the United States? Now, China is an enemy. Yankee imperialism is condemned in China. In the Chinese ideology, we are Satan and the devil. You will certainly find in the Red Book of Mao and the other writings of the Chinese all kinds of programs to subvert governments, feudal capitalist governments around the world, to proclaim wars of liberation among the rural population fought by guerrilla methods until ultimately the base of government in this or that nation is undermined. Lin Piao, who is the second in command of Mao Zedong, wrote 2 years ago a very important article which was called Long Live the Victory of the Wars of Liberation, in which he restated the expansionist, subversive, immoral, if you will, communist ideology which sees communism as quickly dominating the world, filled with all kinds of maxims which are purely amoral, purely military, just forces the midwife of the new era. Change will come only at the point of a gun, and on and on and on. Now, China is an enemy, but Albania is also an enemy. The fact that you are an enemy of a nation does not mean that you threaten that nation unless you have the power to do something about it. The fact that China is an enemy does not mean that China has the ability, the navy, to transport 900 million people, or 800 million people, whatever its population, onto the shores of California. Now, yes, China has the bomb. And in a few years, China will have the means of delivering the bomb over moderate distance with moderate accuracy. This is a fact of life. France also has the bomb. Other nations will have it. The question is, do we increase the possibility of the bomb being used by proclaiming a war against China, proclaiming that China's undermining its subversion as an element of our policy, or do we hasten the day when that bomb will be used? Is China really a threat to the security of the United States? The usual image that most Americans have of China is, I believe, that it's an outlaw nation, expansionist, militarist, without any reason to be trusted, that needs to be quarantined and kept aside. And this has been the fact of our policy. We have denied diplomatic recognition to China. We refuse even to allow reporters to enter the country. There is to be no trade between China and the United States. We're the only nation in the world which has as yet never traded with Red China. We have sponsored the ex-leader of China and his dreams, his impossible dreams of a return to the mainland from Formosa. We have tried to keep China out of the councils of nations. We've acted as if China simply did not exist. But China exists. We must look at the record to see whether, in fact, we do not have in China, as in Russia, a performance gap, a credibility gap, if you will, between the pronouncements of official communism and the performance of the Chinese state. Because one of the great truths of modern history is this, that communism is a superficial overlay over the national interest of the nation. Between communist ideology and Russian foreign policy, there's a tremendous gap. Between communist ideology, the unity of the communist world and its attack on the Western world, and the breakup between China and Russia, between Romania and Russia, between Yugoslavia and Russia, there's a tremendous gap. What I'd like to do for a moment is to examine China's actions to see whether, in fact, there is not a gap between her performance and her philosophy. And if there is that gap, and if in fact China is as convulsed by civil war as the reports seem to say, if in fact Peking seems to have lost the dominance of this great Chinese nation, which is reverting to feudal kingdoms throughout the vast territory which is hers, then I wonder if China has either the power or the will or the strategy with which to be a security risk to the United States. Let's examine China's policy in Asia. It's held to be expansionist and subversive, ruthless. Well, 7 years ago, the Chinese and the Burmese sat down, and there was an old border dispute. And they sat down around a conference table and they worked out that dispute and there was no fighting. And interestingly, it was done at the very time that the Burmese government was jailing and killing what native Communist Party it had. What of the Chinese-Indian War, about which so much has been written? There's an old northeastern boundary of India which was set by a British general, General McMahon. It was never initialed or signed or agreed to by any Chinese government. The Chinese, for a number of years, asked for some kind of meeting, of mediation. This was denied them. And interestingly, when the battle finally came, after events had been exacerbated, the Chinese conquered a good deal more territory than they, in fact, claimed, and they quickly retreated to the claim line, to the line which they claimed was the border between India and China, before the McMahon line had been drawn. Is China really that expansionist? There's really no attempt made by the Chinese to go to the aid of the millions of communist Chinese in Indonesia who were overthrown when Sukarno lost his power and who were slaughtered. What if Korea? What if China's involvement in Korea? When did China enter the Korean War? Not at the beginning. when we persisted against her warning in crossing the 38th parallel and going north to the Yalu, when in fact we were breaking down the buffer zone, which protected China from direct confrontation with American troops. She's given the very same warning in Vietnam, that if we invade north and begin to crack the barrier, the buffer zone, which protects her from our troops, then too we are endangered. And China's always said, in addition to this, that she was pushed into the Korean War, in which she lost 900,000 men by Russia, by a Russian government who wanted to test its officer corps, its tanks, its planes, and the like. But be that as it may, China did not come into the North Korean imbroglio at the very beginning. It came in only after due warning, and only after we persisted in denying that we had heard what we in fact had heard. Now China has men about the world. It sent guns, ammunition to Latin America, to Africa. It's intent on subverting, on doing harm to the Western governments, there's no doubt about it. But what's our CIA doing about the world? And what are the various similar groups of every major nation doing? This is one of the ways, apparently, in which modern diplomats insist on carrying out modern diplomacy. It does not, in and of itself, proof of the effectiveness or the ability of China to create a worldwide subversion. Now, China's a belligerent nation. I would not like to live in China. China's an autocratic nation. It's a dictatorial nation. It's an ideological nation. It's a very young nation. Young in the sense of its first movements into the technological age of our century date back only to the period after the Second World War. But I wonder if we were Chinese, if we were in power in Peking, if we might not be taking some of the very belligerent attitudes towards the United States which we hear echoed in the Peking press. For I submit to you that when you sit in Peking rather than in Cleveland or Washington, the world situation looks somewhat different. What seems to be the truth of it? That there is a Yankee subversion aimed at overthrowing China. After all, it is we who have kept Chiang Kai-shek in power in Formosa for 20 years. It is we who, in the last years of the revolt in China, did all we could to keep Chiang Kai-shek in power. It is we who placed our 7th Fleet in the Formosa Straits. Now we said slyly to ourselves, and perhaps truthfully, that the 7th Fleet was there in order to protect China from Chiang Kai-shek, because we didn't want to have Chiang Kai-shek involve us in a land war. But the Chinese wonder about these quibbles, and they see the carriers, and they see the planes, and they hear the shooting of in practice. And the Chinese know that despite the warnings of 1952, we did cross the 38th parallel and we did move north towards the Yalu. And the Chinese see our activity in Vietnam. And they see how though we had encouraged the Geneva Conference, we began immediately to subvert it. We were determined to create a land base either in Thailand or in South Vietnam, which would give our planes direct bombing access to the mainland, to the heartland of China. And they have read in Congressional Record, which you can read over and over again. I took this one because it's some 20 years old. It's a question and answer between members of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs and one of our Assistant Secretaries of State, and the subject is China. The question by Representative Coudert: did I correctly understand you to say that the heart of the present policy towards China and Formosa is that there is to be kept alive a constant threat of military action vis-a-vis Red China in the hope that at some point there will be an internal breakdown? Mr. Robertson, the Assistant Secretary of State: yes, sir, that is my conception. Question: fundamentally, does that not mean that the United States is undertaking to maintain for an indefinite period of years American dominance in the Far East? Mr. Robertson: yes, exactly. If we sat in the ministry, the foreign ministry in Peking, we would be asking the questions in reverse that I'm asking today. Does the United States not represent a threat to the security of China? And is the United States not an enemy whose forces must be dealt with as best we can? And I'm afraid that we must come to many of the same answers that the Chinese have come to in their deliberations. What we have then is a policy based largely on fear, based on a fundamentally false model of the communist world, which sees it as monolithic when it is in fact polycentric, which sees all communist nations as following a single foreign policy when in fact each has its own national interests, a policy which does not take into consideration the limitations of American power as well as the possible ambitions or aims of American attitude. What's for it then? As you know, I've long believed that our Vietnamese involvement was misguided, and mistaken. I've long believed that the best response to this acknowledgement of our mistakes would be to pull out unilaterally. But I've always believed that the bloodshed which might follow such a pullout would be far less than the bloodshed which will take place if we remain. I have never understood what can be gained, what we stand to gain by mulishness or steadfastness, put it as you will, by escalating the war. General Bonaparte used to say that the bayonets can do everything except that you can't sit on them. What can we do with Vietnam? This rubble, these ravaged people, even if we manage to win at some conference table the independence of the South Vietnamese, which would be defeat for the North Vietnamese. What will we have achieved? Will we have given them stability or freedom, education, schooling, decency, life? What will we have won for them? I've long believed also that the so-called domino theory, which is based on this fear of China to our national security, is essentially false. Nations are not dominoes. Dominoes are little black tiles, each one identical to the previous. The only difference is the number of little white spots on them. And if you touch one domino, yes, and all the dominoes are in a neat row, all the dominoes will fall. But nations aren't dominoes. They're not all built the same way. Nations are groups of people. In some nations, these people feel unity, a sense of national identity. In some nations, these people are being well-ruled and ruled by just laws. In some nations, these people are being abused, and that nation is ripe for revolution. In some nations, subversion will work, and other nations, subversion will not work. In some nations, there is a government which has sufficient contact and respect from its people that it can receive American economic aid and use it wisely. In other nations, there are governments that are so venal and corrupt that they will take all the aid that we give them and bank it in Switzerland, and they will continue to mock their people until the inevitable flash fire of rebellion takes place. There are some governments which will fall whether we stand in Vietnam or we don't stand in Vietnam. And there are other governments which will not fall whether we stand in Vietnam, stand firm or do not. Ultimately, the history of our times reveals this, that great power has great limitations. China is breaking up into a series of feudal provinces. Decentralization is the order of the day. India is breaking up. The Indian government in the last year has had to remove from authority the governments of 8 major provinces in the land because they could no longer rule. New Delhi does no longer control the country. Our own nation is showing signs of this breakup. I begin to hear voices which speak of 4 black states deep in the South, independent. I'm beginning to hear talk of ghettos as self-governing communities set apart from the rest of our world. Wherever we turn, We see the limitations of great power domestically. How much the more so then internationally? No ideology is going to sweep our world. No single government is going to govern our world. Those ideas belong and should have been discarded a decade or more ago. Nationalism is the order of the day. Regional combination is perhaps the most which we can hope for in the near future. And if we admit this, if this is indeed the model of our time, then China does not, I submit, represent an immediate threat to the security of the United States. And our response to Chinese expansion, even as China's response to American expansion, ought to be one which is far more flexible, which reaches to the hearts of men rather than to the governments of men, which seeks to create stability, to override anarchy, which seeks to improve people's standards of living rather than to increase the range and violence of their firepower. I can't begin to lay before you a complete Asian policy for the United States. I'm not an expert in Asia. But I do submit that the kind of military response to a presumed military threat is at its worst stupid and at its best self-defeating. And that if we continue in Thailand, in Laos, in the Philippines, in Vietnam, in Malaysia, in Burma, in India, wherever we're allowed to a greater degree or to less, if we continue to concentrate on the containment of China, on the quarantine of China, if we continue to act as if China doesn't exist and at the same time assume that it's the most important power which in fact does exist, if we continue to look to our Marine Corps rather than to our Peace Corps, we're going to spend, waste, lose billions and billions and billions of dollars. The opportunity to overcome the crisis in our own cities and tens of thousands of the best of our young boys. Policy is here not a matter of philosophy. It's a reality. Thursday, I opened up the newspaper to the obituary page, and there were four American flags dotted across that page. Four young men from Cleveland had been reported dead just the past day. We're not arguing anymore with diplomatic niceties. This isn't a question anymore of writing a policy paper. We're talking of life and death, of a vital commitment, of a commitment which can escalate, as we have seen, in a matter of 2 years to 500,000 men, escalate in a matter of months to 1,000,000 men. And where do we go from there? 5 million? 10 million? It's not all impossible. And if we continue to be mesmerized and hypnotized by this fear of China, rather than to admit that China is one among the nations of the world, not a mad dog nation, no more mad perhaps than Russia, or perhaps in many ways than the United States, no more aggressive perhaps than Russia, and France, and the United States. Another one of the major elements that we must come to grips with as best we can, that we cannot make the world dance to our tune despite our own professions of great power. We will admit this. Then perhaps we can learn to live in a world which will be difficult, but not all will go as we wish it to go.
where a nation may become communist, which we did not want to have become communist, and a communist nation like Indonesia may suddenly become non-communist in a totally unexpected way. But at least we will have the ability to respond flexibly, and out of reason, and not out of some fear, of great hate and personal animus. We're going to live, you and I, through a decade and more of very difficult times. The world is again feeling its oats. Every nation is greedy. Every nation is reaching out for power. Every group of people who is denied power, denied opportunity, is ambitious. It wants its revolution today. It will not wait. These are going to be difficult times. And there are times in which America must use what power it has deliberately. And after great soul searching. For it is not the same thing to say we cannot police the world and to say we must have no commitments around the world. It is not the same thing to say we cannot be the policemen of the world and to say we have no commitments in the world. We do have certain commitments. But these commitments must be those which respond to the really basic needs of national security, and not those which correspond to some blueprint drawn up in some office in Washington about areas we would, if we could, like to control, or some vast irrelevant scheme for the containment of powers in the world. How shall we end? Our prophets say to end always on a word of hope. There is hope. There's a growing realization in this nation that we have overextended ourselves and foolishly committed ourselves, and I am sure that future commitments will not be as easily gained. There's a growing realization in Russia, and hopefully there may be a growing realization in China, that wars are simply too costly. The wars gain you very little except the responsibility of rebuilding the nations that you have conquered. And perhaps slowly people are awakening to the possibilities of coexistence, to the futility of planting the flag, red or red, white, and blue, across the world. At least this must be our hope, because frankly, I don't see any other. Amen.